One of those, of course, led to the White House Situation Room. "Holy God," Ryan said, "it's like some kind of fucking video game. How long have we had this capability?"
"It's pretty new, Jack, and yeah," the vice president agreed, "it is kind of obscene. But, well, it's just what the operators see. I mean, the times I splashed airplanes, I got to see it. Just I was in a G-suit with a Tomcat strapped to my back. Somehow this feels dirtier, man, like watching a guy and a gal go at it, and not in training films."
"What?"
"That's what you call porno flicks on the boats, Jack. Training films. But this is like peeking in a window on a guy's wedding night, and he doesn't know about it. Feels kind of dirty."
"The people will like it," Arnie Van Dam predicted. "The average guy out there, especially kids, to them it'll be like a movie."
"Maybe so, Arnie, but it's a snuff film. Real lives being snuffed out, and in large numbers. That division C.P. Diggs got with his Miller's rockets, I mean, Jesus Christ, it was like an act of an angry pagan god, like the meteor that got the dinosaurs. Like a murderer wasting a kid in a schoolyard," Robbie said, searching for just how dirty it felt to him. But it was business, not personal, for what little consolation that might be to the families of the departed.
"Getting some radio traffic," Tolkunov told General Bondarenko. The intelligence officer had half a dozen electronic intelligence groups out, listening in on the frequencies used by the PLA. They usually spoke in coded phrases which were difficult to figure out, especially since the words changed on a day-to-day basis, along with identifying names for the units and personalities involved. But the security measures tended to fall by the wayside when an emergency happened, and senior officers wanted hard information in a hurry. In this case, Bondarenko had watched the take from Grace Kelly and felt little pity for the victims, wishing only that he'd been the one inflicting the casualties, because it was his country the Chinks had invaded.
"The American artillery doctrine is impressive, isn't it?" Colonel Tolkunov observed.
"They've always had good artillery. But so do we, as this Peng fellow will discover in a few hours," Sink Far East replied.
"What do you think he'll do?"
"It depends on what he finds out," the G2 replied. "The information that gets to him will probably be fairly confusing, and it will concern him, but less than his own mission."
And that made sense, Gennady Yosifovich had to agree. Generals tended to think in terms of the missions assigned to them, leaving the missions of others to those others, trusting them to do the jobs assigned to them. It was the only way an army could function, really. Otherwise, you'd be so worried about what was happening around you that you'd never get your own work done, and the entire thing would quickly grind to a halt. It was called tunnel vision when it didn't work, and good teamwork when it did.
"What about the American deep strikes?"
"Those stealth aircraft are amazing. The Chinese rail system is completely disrupted. Our guests will soon be running short of fuel."
"Pity," Bondarenko observed.
The Americans were efficient warriors, and their doctrine of deep strike, which the Russian military had scarcely considered, could be damned effective if you brought it off, and if your enemy couldn't adapt to it. Whether the Chinese could adapt was something they'd have to see about.
"But they still have 16 mechanized divisions for us to deal with."
"That is so, Comrade General," Tolkunov agreed.
"Falcon 3 to Falcon Leader. I see me a SAM track. It's a holiday," the pilot reported. "Hilltop 2 miles west of the Cloverleaf. Wait, there's a duck there, too."
"Anything else?" Falcon Lead asked. This captain commanded the Apaches tasked to SAM suppression.
"Some light flak, mainly 2-5 Mike Mike, set up around the SAMs. Request permission to fire, over."
"Stand by," Falcon Lead replied.
"Eagle Lead, this is Falcon Lead, over."
"Eagle Lead copies, Falcon," Boyle replied from his Black Hawk.
"We have SAM tracks in view. Permission to engage, over."
Boyle thought fast. His Apaches now had the tank logger in sight and surrounded on three sides. Okay, Falcon was approaching the hill overlooking the logger, codenamed Cloverleaf. Well, it was about time.
"Permission granted,"
Engage the SAMs. Out.
Roger. Engaging. Falcon 3, this is lead. Take him out.
Take your shot, Billy, the pilot told his gunner.
Hellfire now!
The gunner in the front seat triggered off his first missile. The 7-inch-wide missile leaped off its launch rail with a flare of yellow light, and immediately tracked on the laser dot. Through his thermal viewer he saw a dismounted crewman looking that way, and he immediately pointed toward the helicopter. He was yelling to get someone's attention, and the race was between the inbound missile and human reaction time. The missile had to win. He got the attention of someone, maybe his sergeant or lieutenant, who then looked in the direction he was pointing. You could tell by the way he cocked his head that he didn't see anything at first, while the first one was jerking his arm like a fishing pole, and the second one saw it, but by that time there was nothing for him to do but throw himself to the ground. And even that was a waste of energy. The Hellfire hit the base of the launcher assembly and exploded, killing everything within a 10-meter circle.
Tough luck, Joe.
Then the gunner switched over to the other one, the Holiday launcher. This crew had been alerted by the sound, and he could see them scurrying to light up their weapon. They'd just about gotten to their places when the duck launcher blew up. Next came the flak. There were 6 gun mounts, equally divided between 25 and 35 millimeter twin gun sets, and those could be nasty. The Apache closed in. The gunner selected his own 20-millimeter cannon and walked it across every sight. The impacts looked like flash bulbs, and the guns were knocked over, some with exploding ammo boxes.
Eagle lead, Falcon 3, this hilltop has cleaned off. We're circling to make sure. No coverage over the cloverleaf now. It's wide open.
Roger that. And Boyle ordered his Apaches in. It was about as fair as putting a professional boxer into the ring against a 6-year-old. The Apaches circled the lagered tanks, just like Indians in the movies, around a circled wagon train. Except in this one, the settlers couldn't fire back. The Chinese tank crewmen were mainly sleeping outside, next to their mounts. Some crews were in their vehicles, standing guard after a fashion, and some dismounted crewmen were walking around on guard, holding Type 68 rifles. They'd been alerted somewhat by the explosions on the hilltop overlooking the lager. Some of the junior officers were shouting to get their men up and into their tanks, not knowing the threat, but thinking naturally enough that the safe place to be was behind armor, from which place they could shoot back to defend themselves. They could scarcely have been more wrong. The Apaches danced around the lager, sideslipping as the gunners triggered off their missiles. 3 of the PLA tanks used their thermal viewers and actually saw helicopters and shot at them. But the range of the tank guns was only half that of the Hellfires, and all of the rounds fell well short, as did the 6 handheld HN-5 SAMs that were fired into the night. The Hellfires, however, did not, and in every case, only 2 of them missed. The huge warheads had the same effect on the steel tanks that a cherry bomb might have on a plastic model. Turrets flew into the air atop pillars of flame, then crashed back down, usually upside down on the vehicles to which they'd been attached. There'd been 86 tanks here, and that amounted to 3 missiles per helicopter, with a few lucky gunners getting a 4th shot. All in all, the destruction of this brigade took less than 3 minutes, leaving the colonel who'd been in command to stand at his command post with open-mouthed horror at the loss of the 300 soldiers he'd been training for over a year for this very moment. He even survived a strafing of his command section by a departing Apache, seeing the helicopter streak overhead so quickly that he didn't even have time to draw his service pistol.
Eagle lead, Falcon lead. The cloverleaf is toast, and we are RTB over.
Boyle could do little more than shake his head.
Roger, Falcon. Well done, Captain.
Roger, thank you, sir. Out. The Apaches formed up and headed northwest to their base to refuel and rearm for the next mission. Below he could see the 1st Brigade blown through the gap in Chinese lines, heading southeast into the Chinese logistics area. Task Force 77 had been holding station east of the Formosa Strait until receiving orders to race west.
the various air bosses had word that one of their submarines had eliminated a Chinese bomber and fast-attack submarine, which was fine with them, and probably just peachy for the task force commander. Now it was their job to go after the People's Liberation Army Navy, which, they all agreed, was a hell of a name for a maritime armed force. The first aircraft to go off, behind the F-14D's Flying Barrier Combat Air Patrol, or BARCAP, for the task force, were the E-2C Hawkeye radar aircraft, the Navy's two-engine prop-driven mini AWACS. These were tasked to finding targets for the shooters, mainly F-A-18 Hornets. This was to be a complex operation. The task force had three SSNs assigned to sanitize the area of Chi-Com submarines. The task force commander seemed especially concerned with the possibility of a Chinese diesel-powered SSK punching a hole in one of his ships. But that was not an immediate concern for the airmen, unless they could find one tied alongside the pier. The only real problem was target identification. There was ample commercial shipping in the area, and they had orders to leave that entirely alone, even ships flying the PRC flag. Anything with a SAM radar would be engaged beyond visual range. Otherwise, a pilot had to have eyeballs on the target before loosing a weapon. Of weapons, they had plenty, and ships were fragile targets as far as missiles and 1,000-pound bombs were concerned. The overall target was the PLAN South Sea Fleet, based at Guangzhou, better known to Westerners as Canton. The naval base there was well sited for attack, though it was defended by surface-to-air missile batteries and some flak. The F-14s on the lead were guided to aerial targets by the Hawkeyes. Again, since there was commercial air traffic in the sky, the fighter pilots had to close to visual range for a positive ID of their targets. This could be dangerous, but there was no avoiding it. What the Navy pilots didn't know was that the Chinese knew the electronic signature of the APD-138 radar on the E-2Cs, and therefore they also knew that something was coming. Fully 100 Chinese fighters scrambled into the air and set up their own combat air patrol over their east coast. The Hawkeyes spotted that and radioed a warning to the advancing fighters, setting the stage for a massive air engagement in the pre-dawn darkness. There was no elegant way to go about it. Two squadrons of Tomcats, 24 in all, led the strike force. Each carried four AIM-54C Phoenix missiles, plus four AIM-9X Sidewinders. The Phoenixes were old, nearly 15 years old for some of them, and in some cases the solid-fuel motor bodies were developing cracks that would soon become apparent. They had a theoretical range of over 100 miles, however, and that made them useful things to hang on one's airframe. The Hawkeye crews had orders to make careful determination of what was a duck and what was a goose, but it was agreed quickly that two or more aircraft flying in close formation were not airbuses full of civilian passengers, and the Tomcats were authorized to shoot a full 100 miles off the Chinese mainland. The first salvo was composed of 48. Of these, six self-destructed within 500 yards of their launching aircraft, to the displeased surprise of the pilots involved. The remaining 42 streaked upward in a ballistic path to a height of over 100,000 feet, before tipping over at Mach 5 speed and switching on their millimeter-band Doppler homing radars. By the end of their flight, their motors were burned out, and they did not leave the smoke trail that pilots look for. Thus, though the Chinese pilots knew that they'd been illuminated, they couldn't see the danger coming, and therefore could not see anything to evade. The 42 Phoenixes started going off in their formations, and the only survivors were those who broke into radical turns when they saw the first warheads go off. All in all, the 48 launches resulted in 32 kills. The surviving Chinese pilots were shaken, but also enraged. As one man, they turned east and lit up their search radars, looking for targets for their own air-to-air missiles. These they found, but beyond range of their weapons. The senior officer surviving the initial attack ordered them to go to afterburner and streak east, and at a range of 60 miles they fired off their PL-10 radar-guided air-to-air missiles. These were a copy of the Italian Aspide, in turn a copy of the old American AIM-7E Sparrow. To track a target, they required that the launching aircraft keep itself and its radar pointed at the target. In this case, the Americans were heading in as well, with their own radars emitting, and what happened was a great game of chicken, with the fighter pilots on either side unwilling to turn and run. And besides, they all figured that to do so merely guaranteed one's death. And so the race was between airplanes and missiles. But the PL-10 had a speed of Mach 4 against the Phoenix's Mach 5. Back on the Hawkeyes, the crewmen kept track of the engagement. Both the aircraft and the streaking missiles were visible on the scopes, and there was a collective holding of breath for this one. The Phoenixes hit first, killing 31 more PLA-AF fighters, and also turning off their radars rather abruptly. That made some of their missiles go dumb, but not all. And the 6 Chinese fighters that survived the second Phoenix barrage found themselves illuminating targets for a total of 39 PL-10s, which angled for only 4 Tomcats. The American pilots affected by this saw them coming, and the feeling wasn't particularly pleasant. Each went to afterburner and dove for the deck, losing every bit of chaff and flares he had in his protection pods, plus turning the jamming pods up to max power. One got clean away. Another lost most of them in the chaff, where the Chinese missiles exploded like fireworks in his wake. But one of the F-14s had 19 missiles chasing him alone, and there was no avoiding them all. The third missile got close enough to trigger its warhead, and then 9 more, and the Tomcat was reduced to chaff itself, along with its 2-man crew. That left 1 Navy fighter whose radar intercept officer ejected safely, though the pilot did not. The remaining Tomcats continued to bore in. They were out of Phoenix missiles now, and closed to continue the engagement with Sidewinders. Losing comrades did nothing more than anger them for the moment, and this time it was the Chinese who turned back and headed for their coast, chased by a cloud of heat-seeking missiles. This bar fight had the effect of clearing the way for the strike force. The PLAN base had 12 piers with ships alongside, and the United States Navy went after its Chinese counterpart. As usually happened, on the principle that in war people invariably killed those most like themselves before going after the different ones. The first to draw the wrath of the Hornets were the submarines. They were mainly old Romeo-class diesel boats, long past whatever prime they'd once had. They were mainly rafted in pairs, and the Hornet drivers struck at them with skippers and slams. The former was a 1,000-pound bomb with a rudimentary guidance package attached, plus a rocket motor taken off obsolete missiles, and they proved adequate to the task. The pilots tried to guide them between the rafted submarines, so as to kill 2 with a single weapon, and that worked in 3 out of 5 attempts. SLAM was a land attack version of the Harpoon anti-ship missile, and these were directed at the port and maintenance facilities without which a naval base is just a cluttered beach. The damage done looked impressive on the videotapes. Other aircraft tasked to a mission called Iron Hand sought out Chinese missile and flak batteries, and engaged those at safe distance with HARM anti-radiation missiles, which sought out and destroyed acquisition and illumination radars with high reliability. All in all, the first U.S. Navy attack on the mainland of East Asia since Vietnam went off well, eliminating 12 PRC warships and laying waste to one of its principal naval bases. Other bases were attacked with Tomahawk cruise missiles launched mainly from surface ships. Every PLAN base over a swath of 500 miles of coast took one form of fire or another, and the ship count was jacked up to 16, all in a period of a little over an hour. The American tactical aircraft returned to their carriers, having spilled the blood of their enemies, though also having lost some of their own. Chapter 58. Political Fallout. It was a difficult night for Marshal Luo Kong, the defense minister for the People's Republic of China. He'd gone to bed about 11 the previous night, concerned with the ongoing operations of his military forces, but pleased that they seemed to be going well. And then, just after he'd closed his eyes, the phone rang. His official car came at once to convey him to his office, but he didn't enter it. Instead, he went to the Defense Ministry's communication center, where he found a number of senior and mid-level officers going over fragmentary information and trying to make sense of it. Minister Luo's presence didn't help them, but just added stress to the existing chaos. Nothing seemed clear, except that they could identify holes in their information. The 65th Army had seemingly dropped off the face of the earth. Its commanding general had been visiting one of his divisions, along with his staff, and hadn't been heard from since 0200 or so. Nor had the division's commanding general. In fact, nothing at all was known about what was happening up there. To fix that, Marshal Luo ordered a helicopter to fly up from the depot at Sunwu. Then came reports from Harbin and Bayan of air raids that had damaged the railroads. A colonel of engineers was dispatched to look into that. But just when he thought he'd gotten a handle on the difficulties in Siberia, then came reports of an air attack on the fleet base at Guangzhou, and then the lesser naval bases at Haikuo, Shantou, and Xiachuandao. In each case, the headquarters facilities seemed hard hit, since there was no response from the local commanders. Most disturbing of all was the report of huge losses to the fighter regiments in the area. Reports of American naval aircraft making the attacks. Then, finally, worst of all, a pair of automatic signals. The distress buoys from his country's only nuclear-powered missile submarine and the Hunter submarine detailed to protect her, the Heilong, were both radiating their automated messages. It struck the marshal as unlikely to the point of impossibility that so many things could have happened at once. And yet there was more. Border radar emplacements were off the air and could not be raised on radio or telephone. Then came another phone call from Siberia. One of the divisions on the left shoulder of the breakthrough, the one the commanding general of 65th Type B Group Army had been visiting a few hours before, reported. That is, a junior communications officer said, a subunit of the division reported, that unknown armored forces had lanced through its western defenses going east and disappeared.
"How the hell does an enemy attack successfully and disappear?" the marshal had demanded, in a voice to make the young captain wilt. "Who reported this?"
"He identified himself as a major in the 3rd Battalion, 745th Guards Infantry Regiment, Comrade Marshal," was the trembling reply. "The radio connection was scratchy, or so it was reported to us."
"And who made the report?"
"A Colonel Zhao, senior communications officer in the intelligence staff of 71st Type C Group Army north of Bayan. They are detailed to border security in the breakthrough sector," the captain explained.
"I know that,"
Luo bellowed, taking out his rage on the nearest target of opportunity. "Comrade Marshal," said a new voice. It was Major General Wei Daoming, one of Luo's senior aides, just called in from his home after one more of a long string of long days, and showing the strain, but trying to smooth the troubled waters even so.
"You should let me and my staff assemble this information in such a way that we can present it to you in an orderly manner."
"Yes, Wei, I suppose so."
Luo knew that this was good advice, and Wei was a career intelligence officer, accustomed to organizing information for his superiors.
"Quick as you can."
"Of course, Comrade Minister," Wei said, to remind Luo that he was a political figure now rather than the military officer he'd grown up as. Luo went to the VIP sitting room, where green tea was waiting. He reached into the pocket of his uniform tunic and pulled out some cigarettes, strong, unfiltered ones to help him wake up. They made him cough, but that was all right. By the third cup of tea, Wei returned with a pad of paper scribbled with notes.
"So, what is happening?"
"The picture is confused, but I will tell you what I know and what I think," Wei began. "We know that General Qi of 65th Army is missing, along with his staff. They were visiting 191st Infantry Division, just north and west of our initial breakthrough. The 191st is completely off the air as well. So is the 615th Independent Tank Brigade, part of 65th Army. Confused reports talk of an air attack on the tank brigade, but nothing precise is known. The 735th Guards Infantry Regiment of the 191st Division is also off the air, cause unknown. You ordered a helicopter out of Sunwu to take a look and report back. The helicopter will get off at dawn. Well and good. Next, there are additional reports from that sector, none of which make sense or help form any picture of what is happening.
So I have ordered the intelligence staff of the 71st Army to send a reconnaissance team across the river and ascertain what's happening there and report back. That will take about 3 hours. The good news is that General Peng Shiwang remains in command of 34th Shock Army and will be at the gold mine before midday. Our armored spearhead is deep within enemy territory. I expect the men are waking up right now and will be moving within the hour to continue their attack. Now, this news from the Navy people is confusing, but it's not really a matter of consequence. I've directed the commander of South Sea Fleet to take personal charge of the situation and report back. So say about 3 hours for that. So, Comrade Minister, we will have decent information shortly, and then we can start addressing the situation. Until then, General Peng will soon resume his offensive, and by evening, our country will be much richer, Wei concluded. He knew how to keep his minister happy. His reward for this was a grunt and a nod. Now, General Wei went on, why don't you get a few hours of sleep while we maintain the watch? Good idea, Wei. Luo took 2 steps to the couch and lay down across it. Wei opened the door, turned off the lights, then he closed the door behind himself. The communication center was only a few more steps. Now, he said, stealing a smoke from a major, what the hell is happening out there? If you want an opinion, a colonel of intelligence said, I think the Americans just flexed their muscles, and the Russians will do so in a few hours. What? Why do you say that? And why the Russians? Where has their Air Force been? Where have their attack helicopters been? We don't know, do we? Why don't we know? Because the Americans have swatted our airplanes out of the sky like flies, that's why. We've deluded ourselves that the Russians don't want to fight, haven't we? A man named Hitler once thought the same thing. He died a few years later, the history books say. We similarly deluded ourselves into thinking the Americans would not strike us hard for political reasons. Wei, some of our political leaders have been off chasing the dragon. The aphorism referred to opium smoking, a popular, if illegal, pastime in the southern part of China a few centuries before. There were no political considerations. They were merely building up their forces, which takes time. And the Russians didn't fight us because they wanted us to get to the end of the logistical string. And then the fucking Americans cut that string off at Harbin and Bayan. General Peng's tanks are nearly 300 kilometers inside Russia now, with only 200 kilometers of fuel in their tanks, and there will be no more fuel coming up to them. We've taken over 2,000 tanks and turned their crews into badly trained light infantry. That is what's happening, Comrade Wei, the colonel concluded. You can say that sort of thing to me, Colonel. Say it before Minister Luo and your wife will pay the state for the bullet day after tomorrow, Wei warned. Well, I know it, Colonel Geng Heiping replied. What will happen to you later today, Comrade General Wei, when you organize the information and find out that I am correct? The remainder of today will have to take care of itself, was the fatalistic reply. One thing at a time, gang. Then he assembled a team of officers and gave them each a task to perform, found himself a chair to sit in, and wondered if Geng might have a good feel for the situation. Colonel Geng?
Yes, Comrade General.
What do you know of the Americans? I was in our embassy in Washington until 18 months ago. While there, I studied their military quite closely.
And are they capable of what you just said?
Comrade General, for the answer to that question, I suggest you consult the Iranians and the Iraqis. I'm wondering what they might try next, but thinking exactly like an American is a skill I have never mastered.
They're moving, Major Tucker reported with a stretch and a yawn. Their reconnaissance element just started rolling. Your people have pulled way back. How come?
I ordered them to collect Comrade Gogol before the Chinese kill him, Colonel Tolkunov told the American.
You look tired.
Hell, what's 36 hours in the same chair?
A hell of a sore back, that's what it is, Tucker didn't say.
Despite the hours, he was having the time of his life.
For an Air Force officer who'd flunked out of pilot training, making him forever an unrated weenie in Air Force parlance, a fourth-class citizen in the Air Force pecking order, below even helicopter pilots, he was earning his keep more and better than he'd ever done. He'd probably been more valuable to his side in this war than even that Colonel Winters, with all his air-to-air snuffs. But if anyone ever said such a thing to him, he'd have to aw shucks it and look humbly down at his shoes. Humble my ass, Tucker thought. He was proving the value of a new and untested asset, and doing so like the Red Baron in his Red Fokker trimotor. The Air Force was not a service whose members cultivated humility, but his lack of pilot's wings had compelled him to do just that for all 10 of his years of uniformed service. The next generation of UAVs would have weapons attached, and maybe even be able to go air-to-air. And then, maybe, he'd show those strutting fighter jock itches who had the real balls in this man's Air Force. Until then, he'd just have to be content gathering information that helped the Russians kill Joe Chink and all his brothers. And if this was Nintendo War, then little Danny Tucker was the by-God cock of the by-God walk in this virtual world.
"You have been most valuable to us, Major Tucker."
"Thank you, sir. Glad to help," Tucker replied with his best little boy smile. "Maybe I'll grow me a good mustache." He set the thought aside with a smile and sipped some instant coffee from an MRE pack. The extra caffeine was about the only thing keeping him up at the moment. But the computer was doing most of the work, and it showed the Chinese reconnaissance tracks moving north.
"Son of a bitch," Captain Alexandrov breathed.
He'd heard about Gogol's wolf pelts on state radio, but he hadn't seen the TV coverage, and the sight took his breath away. Touching one, he halfway expected it to be cold and stiff like wire. But no, it was like the perfect hair of a perfect blonde.
"And who might you be?"
The old man was holding a rifle and had a decidedly gimlet eye.
"I am Captain Fedor Ilyich Alexandrov, and I imagine you are Pavel Petrovich Gogol."
A nod and a smile.
"You like my furs, comrade captain?"
"They are unlike anything I have ever seen. We have to take these with us."
"Take? Take where? I'm not going anywhere," Pasha said.
"Comrade Gogol, I have my orders. To get you away from here.
Those orders come from headquarters, Far East Command, and those orders will be obeyed, Pavel Petrovich." "No chink is going to chase me off my land," his old voice thundered.
"No, comrade Gogol, but soldiers of the Russian army will not leave you here to die."
"So, that is the rifle you killed Germans with?" "Yes. Many, many Germans," Gogol confirmed.
"Then come with us, and maybe you can kill some yellow invaders."
"Who exactly are you?"
"Reconnaissance Company Commander, 265 Motor Rifle Division. We've been playing hide-and-seek with the Chinks for 4 long days, and now we are ready to do some real fighting. Join us, Pavel Petrovich. You can probably teach us a few things we need to know." The young, handsome captain spoke in his most reasonable and respectful tones, for this old warrior truly deserved it. The tone turned the trick.
"You promise me I will get to take one shot?"
"My word as a Russian officer, comrade," Alexandrov pledged, with a bob of his head.
"Then I come."
Gogol was already dressed for it. The heat in his cabin was turned off. He shouldered his old rifle and an ammunition pack containing 40 rounds. He'd never gone into the field with more than that, and walked to the door.
"Help me with my wolves, boy, will you?"
"Gladly, grandfather." Then Alexandrov found out how heavy they were. But he and Buikov managed to toss them inside their BRM, and the driver headed off.
"Where are they?"
"About 10 kilometers back. We've been in visual contact with them for days, but they've pulled us back. Away from them."
"Why?"
"To save you, you old fool," Buikov observed with a laugh.
"And to save these pelts. These are too good to drape over the body of some Chinese strumpet."
"I think, Pasha,
"I am not sure," the captain said, "but I think it's time for our Chinese guests to get a proper Russian welcome."
"Captain, look!" the driver called.
Alexandrov lifted his head out the big top hatch and looked forward. A senior officer was waving to him to come forward more quickly. 3 minutes later, they halted alongside him.
"You are Alexandrov?"
"Yes, Comrade General," the young man confirmed to the senior officer.
"I am General Sinyavsky. You've done well, boy. Come out here and talk to me,"
he ordered in a gruff voice that was not, however, unkind. Alexandrov had only once seen his senior commander, and then only at a distance. He was not a large man, but you didn't want him as a physical enemy in a small room. He was chewing on a cigar that had gone out seemingly hours before, and his blue eyes blazed.
"Who is this?" Sinyavsky demanded.
Then his face changed.
"Are you the famous Pasha?" he asked more respectfully. "Senior Sergeant Gogol of the Iron and Steel Division," the old man said with great dignity,
and a salute which Sinyavsky returned crisply.
"I understand you killed some Germans in your day. How many, Sergeant?" "Count for yourself, Comrade General," Gogol said, handing his rifle over.
"Damn," the general observed, looking at the notches, like those on the pistol of some American cowboy.
"I believe you really did it. But combat is a young man's game, Pavel Petrovich. Let me get you to a place of safety."
Gogol shook his head.
"This captain promised me one shot, or I would not have left my home."
"Is that a fact?" The commanding general of 265th Motor Rifle looked around.
"Captain Alexandrov, very well. We'll give our old comrade his one shot."
He pointed to a place on the map before him.
"This should be a good spot for you. And when you can, get him the hell away from here," Sinyavsky told the young man. "Head back this way to our lines. They'll be expecting you. Boy, you've done a fine job shadowing them all the way up. Your reward will be to see how we greet the bastards."
"Behind the reconnaissance element is a large force."
"I know. I've been watching them on TV for a day and a half. But our American friends have cut off their supplies. And we will stop them. And we will stop them right here."
Alexandrov checked the map reference. It looked like a good spot with a good field of fire. And best of all, an excellent route to run away on.
"How long?" he asked. 2 hours, I should think. Their main body is catching up with the screen. Your first job is to make their screen vehicles disappear."
"Yes, Comrade General, that we can do for you," the captain responded with enthusiasm. Sunrise found Mary and Diggs in a strangely bizarre environment. Physically, the surroundings reminded him of Fort Carson, Colorado, with its rolling hills and patchy pine woods. But it was unlike America in its lack of paved roads or civilization. And that explained why the Chinese had invaded here. With little civilian population out here, there was no infrastructure or population base to provide for the area's defense. And that had made things a lot easier for John Chinaman. Diggs didn't mind it either. It was like his experience in the Persian Gulf. No non-combatants to get in the way. And that was good. But there were a lot of Chinese to get in the way. Mike Francisco's 1st Brigade had debouched into the main logistics area for the Chinese advance. The ground was carpeted with trucks and soldiers, but while most of them were armed, few were organized into cohesive tactical units, and that made all the difference. Colonel Miguel Francisco's brigade of 4 battalions had been organized for combat with the infantry and tank battalions integrated into unified battalion task groups of mixed tanks and Bradleys, and these were sweeping across the ground like a harvesting machine in Kansas in August. If it was painted green, it was shot. The monstrous Abrams main battle tanks moved over the rolling ground like creatures from Jurassic Park, alien, evil, and unstoppable, their gun turrets traversing left and right, but without firing their main guns. The real work was being done by the tank commanders and their M250 machine guns, which could turn any truck into an immobile collection of steel and canvas. Just a short burst into the engine made sure that the pistons would never move again, and the cargo in the back would remain where it was, for inspection by intelligence officers, or destruction by explosives carrying engineer troops who came behind the tanks in their Humvees. Some resistance was offered by the Chinese soldiers, but only by the dumb ones, and never for long. Even those with man-portable anti-tank weapons rarely got close enough to use them, and those few who popped up from wolf holes only scratched the paint on the tanks, and usually paid for their foolishness with their lives. At one point, a battalion of infantry did launch a deliberate attack, supported by mortars that forced the tank and Bradley crews to button up and reply with organized fire. 5 minutes of 155mm fire and a remorseless advance by the Bradleys, spitting fire from their chain guns and through the firing ports for the mounted infantry inside, made them look like fire-breathing dragons, and these dragons were not a sign of good luck for the Chinese soldiers. That battalion evaporated in 20 minutes, along with its dedicated but doomed commander. Intact enemy armored vehicles were rarely seen by the advancing 1st Brigade. Where it went, Apache attack helicopters had gone before, looking for targets for their Hellfire missiles, and killing them before the ground troops could get close. All in all, it was a perfect military operation, totally unfair in the balance of forces. It wasn't the least bit sporting, but a battlefield is not an Olympic stadium, and there were no uniformed officials to guard the supposed rules of fair play. The only exciting thing was the appearance of a Chinese Army helicopter, and two Apaches blazed after it and destroyed it with air-to-air missiles, dropping it in the Amur River close to the floating bridges, which were now empty of traffic, but not yet destroyed.
"What have you learned, Wei?" Marshal Luo asked, when he emerged from the conference room he'd used for his nap.
"The picture is still unclear in some respects, Comrade Minister," the general answered.
"Then tell me what is clear," Luo ordered.
"Very well. At sea we have lost a number of ships. This evidently includes our ballistic missile submarine and its escorting hunter submarine. Cause unknown. But their emergency beacons deployed and transmitted their programmed messages starting at about 0200 hours. Also lost are 7 surface warships of various types from our South Sea Fleet. Also, 7 fleet bases were attacked by American aircraft, believed to be naval carrier aircraft, along with a number of surface-to-air missile and radar sites on the southeastern coast. We've succeeded in shooting down a number of American aircraft, but in a large fighter battle. We took serious losses to our fighter regiments in that region.
"Is the American Navy attacking us?" Luo asked.
"It appears that they are, yes," General Wei answered, choosing his words with care. "We estimate 4 of their aircraft carriers, judging by the number of aircraft involved. As I said, reports are that we handled them roughly, but our losses were severe as well."
"What are their intentions?" the minister asked.
"Unclear. They've done serious damage to a number of bases, and I doubt we have a single surface ship surviving at sea. Our Navy personnel have not had a good day," Wei concluded. "But that is not really a matter of importance."
"The attack on the missile submarine is," Luo replied. "That is an attack on a strategic asset. That is something we must consider."
He paused.
"Go on, what else?"
"General Chi of 65th Army is missing and presumed dead, along with all of his senior staff. We've made repeated attempts to raise him by radio with no result. The 191st Infantry Division was attacked last night by heavy forces of unknown identity. They sustained heavy losses due to artillery and aircraft, but 2 of their regiments report that they are holding their positions. The 735th Guards Infantry Regiment evidently took the brunt of the attack, and reports from there are fragmentary. The most serious news is from Harbin and Bayan. Enemy aircraft attacked all of the railroad bridges in both cities, and all of them took damage. Rail traffic north has been interrupted. We're trying now to determine how quickly it might be re-established."
"Is there any good news?" Marshal Luo asked.
"Yes, Comrade Minister.
General Peng and his forces are getting ready now to resume their attack.
We expect to have the Russian gold field in our control by midday, Wei answered,
inwardly glad that he didn't have to say what had happened to the logistical train behind Peng and his 34th Shark Army. Too much bad news could get the messenger killed, and he was the messenger.
I want to talk to Peng. Get him on the phone, Luo ordered.
Telephone lines have been interrupted briefly, but we do have radio contact with him, Wei told his superior.
Then get me Peng on the radio, Luo repeated his order.
What is it, Hua? Peng asked.
Couldn't he even take a piss without interruption? Radio, it's the defense minister, his operations officer told him.
Wonderful, the general groused, heading back to his command track as he buttoned his fly.
He ducked to get inside and lifted the microphone.
This is General Peng.
This is Marshal Luo. What is your situation? The voice asked through the static.
Comrade Marshal, we will be setting off in 10 minutes. We have still not made contact with the enemy, and our reconnaissance has seen no sizable enemy formations in our area. Have you developed any intelligence we can use?
Be advised we have aerial photography of Russian mechanized units to your west, probably division strength. I would advise you to keep your mechanized forces together and guard your left flank.
Yes, Comrade Marshal, I am doing that, Peng assured him. The real reason he stopped every day was to allow his divisions to close up, keeping his fist tight. Better yet, 29th Taipei Group Army was right behind his if he needed support.
I recommend that 43rd Army be tasked to flank guard.
I will give the order, Luo promised.
How far will you go today?
Comrade Marshal, I will send a truckload of gold back to you this very evening.
Question. What is this I've heard about damage to our line of supply?
There was an attack last night on some railroad bridges in Harbin and Bayan, but nothing we can't fix.
Very well, Comrade Marshal. I must see to my dispositions.
Carry on, then. Out.
Peng set the microphone back in its holder.
Nothing he can't fix, he says.
You know what those bridges are like. You'd need a nuclear weapon to hurt them, Colonel Hua Chenggong observed confidently.
Yes, I would agree with that. Peng stood, buttoned his tunic, and reached for a mug of morning tea.
Tell the advance guard to prepare to move out. I'm going up front this morning, Hua. I want to see this gold mine for myself.
How far up front? The operations officer asked.
With the lead elements. A good officer leads from the front, and I want to see how our people move. Our reconnaissance screen hasn't detected anything, has it?
Well, no, Comrade General, but... But what? Peng demanded.
But a prudent commander leaves leading to lieutenants and captains, Hua pointed out.
Hua, sometimes you talk like an old woman, Peng chided.
There, Yefremov said, they took the bait.
It was just after midnight in Moscow, and the embassy of the People's Republic of China had most of its lights off, but not all. More to the point, three windows had their lights on, and their shades fully open, and they were all in a row. It was just as perfect as what the Americans called a sting operation. He'd stood over Suvorov's shoulder as he'd typed the message.
I have the pieces in place now. I have the pieces in place now. If you wish for me to carry out the operation, leave three windows in a row with the lights on and the windows fully open.
Yefremov had even had a television camera record the event, down to the point where the traitor Suvorov had tapped the enter key to send the letter to his chink controller. And he'd gotten a TV news crew to record the event as well, because the Russian people seemed to trust the semi-independent media more than their government now, for some reason or other. Good, now they had proof positive that the Chinese government was conspiring to kill President Grushevoy. That would play well in the international press. And it wasn't an accident. The windows all belonged to the chief of mission in the PRC embassy, and he was, right now, asleep in his bed. They'd made sure of that by calling him on the phone 10 minutes earlier.
So, what do we do now?
We tell the president, and then, I expect, we tell the TV news people. And we probably spare Suvorov's life. I hope he likes it in the labor camp.
What about the killings?
Yefremov shrugged. He only killed a pimp and a whore. No great loss, is it?
Senior Lieutenant Komonov had not exactly enjoyed his last 4 days, but at least they'd been spent profitably training his men to shoot. The reservists, now known as Boyar Force, had spent them doing gunnery, and they'd fired 4 basic loads of shells over that time, more than any of them had ever shot on active duty, but the Nevers depot had been well stocked with shells. Officers assigned to the formation by Far East Command told them that the Americans had moved by to their south the previous day, and that their mission was to slide north of them, and do it today. Only 30 kilometers stood between them and the Chinese, and he and his men were ready to pay them a visit. The throaty rumble of his own diesel engine was answered by the thunder of 200 others, and Boyar started moving northeast through the hills.
Peng and his command section raced forward, calling ahead on their radios to clear the way, and the military police troops doing traffic control waved them through. Soon they reached the command section of the 302nd Armored, his leading fist formation, commanded by Major General Gay Lee, a squat officer whose incipient corpulence made him look rather like one of his tanks.
"Are you ready, Gay?" Peng asked.
The man was well named for his task. Gay had the primary meaning of spear.
"We are ready," the tanker replied. "My leading regiments are turning over and straining at the leash."
"Well, shall we observe from the front together?"
"Yes."
Gay jumped aboard his own command tank. He preferred this to a personnel carrier, despite the poorer radios, and led the way forward. Peng immediately established a direct radio connection with his subordinate.
"How far to the front?"
3 kilometers. The reconnaissance people are moving now, and they are another 2 kilometers ahead.
"Lead on, Gay," Peng urged. "I want to see that gold mine."
It was a good spot, Alexandrov thought, unless the enemy got his artillery set up sooner than expected, and he hadn't seen or heard Chinese artillery yet. He was on the fairly steep reverse side of an open slope that faced south, rather like a lengthy ramp, perhaps 3 kilometers in length, not unlike a practice shooting range at a regimental base. The sun was starting to crest the eastern horizon, and they could see now, which always made soldiers happy. Pasha had stolen a spare coat and laid his rifle across it, standing in the open top hatch of the BRM, looking through the telescopic sight of his rifle.
"So, what was it like to be a sniper against the Germans?" Alexandrov asked, once he'd settled himself in.
"It was good hunting. I tried to stick to killing officers. You have more effect on them that way," Gogol explained. "A German private? Well, he was just a man. An enemy, of course, but he probably had no more wish to be on a battlefield than I did. But an officer, those were the ones who directed the killing of my comrades. And when you got one of them, you confused the enemy."
"How many?"
"Lieutenants, 18. Captains, 12. Only 3 majors, but 9 colonels. I decapitated 9 Fritz regiments. Then, of course, sergeants and machine-gun crews, but I don't remember them as well as the colonels." "I can still see every one of those, my boy," Gogol said, tapping the side of his head.
"Did they ever try to shoot at you?"
"Mainly with artillery," Pasha answered. "A sniper affects the morale of a unit. Men do not like being hunted like game. But the Germans didn't use snipers as skillfully as we did, and so they answered me with field guns."
"That," he admitted, "could be frightening, but it really told me how much the Fritzes feared me," Pavel Petrovich concluded with a cruel smile.
"There," Buikov pointed, "just off the trees to the left."
"Ah," Gogol said, looking through his gun sight. "Ah, yes."
Alexandrov laid his binoculars on the fleeting shape.
It was the vertical steel side on a Chinese infantry carrier, one of those he'd been watching for some days now. He lifted his radio.
"This is Green Wolf 1. Enemy in sight. Map reference 285. 906. One infantry track coming north. Will advise."
"Understood, Green Wolf," the radio crackled back. "Now we must just be patient," Fedor Ilyich said. He stretched, touching the camouflage net that he'd ordered set up the moment they'd arrived in this place. To anyone more than 300 meters away, he and his men were just part of the hill crest. Next to him, Sergeant Buikov lit a cigarette, blowing out the smoke.
"That is bad for us," Gogol advised. "It alerts the game."
"They have little noses," Buikov replied.
"Yes, and the wind is in our favor," the old hunter conceded.
"Lordy, lordy," Major Tucker observed. "They've bunched up some." It was Grace Kelly again, looking down on the battlefield, to be like Pallas Athena looking down on the plains of Troy. And about as pitilessly. The ground had opened up a little, and the corridor they moved across was a good 3 kilometers wide. Enough for a battalion of tanks to travel line abreast. A regiment in columns of battalions. 3 lines of 35 tanks each, with tracked infantry carriers interspersed with them. Colonels Aliyev and Tolkunov stood behind him, speaking in Russian over their individual telephones to the 265th Motor Rifles command post. In the night, the entire 201st had finally arrived, plus leading elements of the 80th and 44th. There were now nearly 3 divisions to meet the advancing Chinese, and included in that were 3 full divisional artillery sets, plus, Tucker saw for the first time, a shitload of attack helicopters sitting on the ground 30 kilometers back from the point of expected contact. Joe Chink was driving into a motherfucker of an ambush. Then a shadow crossed under Grace Kelly, out of focus, but something moving fast. It was 2 squadrons of F-16C fighter bombers, and they were armed with Smart Pigs. That was the nickname for J-SOW, the joint standoff weapon. The night before, other F-16s, the CG version, the new and somewhat downsized version of the F-4G Wild Weasel, had gone into China and struck at the line of border radar transmitters, hitting them with HARM anti-radar missiles and knocking most of them off the air. That denied the Chinese foreknowledge of the inbound strike. They had been guided by 2 E-3B Sentry aircraft, and protected by 3 squadrons of F-15C Eagle air superiority fighters in the event some Chinese fighters appeared again to die. But there had been little such fighter activity in the past 36 hours. The Chinese fighter regiments had paid a bloody price for their pride, and were staying close to home in what appeared to be a defense mode, on the principle that if you weren't attacking, then you were defending. In fact, they were doing little but flying standing patrols over their own bases. That's how thoroughly they had been whipped by American and Russian fighters. And that left the air in American and Russian control, which was going to be bad news for the People's Liberation Army. The F-16s were at 30,000 feet, holding to the east. They were several minutes early for the mission, and circled while awaiting word to attack. Some concertmaster was stage-managing this, they all thought. They hoped he didn't break his little baton-stick thing.
"Getting closer," Pasha observed with studied nonchalance.
"Range?"
Alexandrov asked the men down below in the track.
2,100 meters within range," Buikov reported from inside the gun turret.
"The Fox and the Gardner approach, comrade captain."
"Leave them be for the moment, Boris Yevgenievich."
"As you say, comrade captain."
Buikov was comfortable with the no-shoot rule, for once.
"How much farther to the reconnaissance screen?" Peng asked.
2 more kilometers, Gay replied over the radio. "But that might not be a good idea."
"Gay, have you turned into an old woman?" Peng asked lightly.
"Comrade, it is the job of lieutenants to find the enemy, not the job of senior generals," the division commander replied in a reasonable voice.
Is there any reason to believe the enemy is nearby?
We are in Russia, Peng. They're here somewhere.
He is correct, Comrade General, Colonel Hua Chenggong pointed out to his commander.
Rubbish. Go forward. Tell the reconnaissance element to stop and await us, Peng ordered.
A good commander leads from the front, he announced over the radio.
Oh, shit, Gay observed in his tank. Peng wants to show off his Gigi.
Move out, he ordered his driver, a captain. His entire crew was made of officers.
Let's lead the Emperor to the recon screen.
The brand new T-98 tank surged forward, throwing up two rooster tails of dirt as it accelerated. General Gay was in the commander's hatch, with a major acting as gunner, a duty he practiced diligently because it was his job to keep his general alive in the event of contact with the enemy. For the moment, it meant going ahead of the senior general with blood in his eye.
"Why did they stop?" Buikov asked.
The PLA tracks had suddenly halted 900 meters off, all five of them, and now the crews dismounted, manifestly to take a stretch, and five of them lit up smokes.
"They must be waiting for something," the captain thought aloud.
Then he got on the radio.
"Green Wolf here. The enemy has halted about a kilometer south of us. They're just sitting still."
"Have they seen you?"
"No, they've dismounted to take a piss, looks like, just standing there."
"We have them in range, but I don't want to shoot until they're closer," Alexandrov reported.
"Very well, take your time. There's no hurry here. They're walking into the parlor very nicely."
"Understood. Out."
He set the mic down.
"Is it time for morning break?"
"They haven't been doing that the last 4 days, Comrade Captain," Buikov reminded his boss.
"They appear relaxed enough."
"I could kill any of them now," Gogol said. "But they're all privates, except for that one."
"That's the fox. He's a lieutenant, likes to run around a lot. The other officer's the gardener. He likes playing with plants," Buikov told the old man.
"Killing a lieutenant's not much better than killing a corporal," Gogol observed. "There's too many of them."
"What's this?" Buikov said from his gunner seat.
"Tank. Enemy tank coming around the left edge, range 5,000.
"I see it," Alexandrov reported.
"Just one?"
"Only one tank."
"Oh, all right, there's a carrier with it."
"It's a command track. Look at all those antennas," Buikov called. The gunner's sight was more powerful than Alexandrov's binoculars. The captain couldn't confirm that for another minute or so.
"Oh, yes, that's a command track, all right. I wonder who's in it."
"There they are," the driver called back. "The reconnaissance section, 2 kilometers ahead, Comrade General."
"Excellent," Peng observed, standing up to look out of the top of his command track with his binoculars, good Japanese ones from Nikon. There was Gay in his command tank, 30 meters off to the right, protecting him as though he were a good dog outside the palace of some ancient nobleman. Peng couldn't see anything to be concerned about. It was a clear day, with some puffy white clouds at 3,000 meters or so. If there were American fighters up there, he wasn't going to worry about them. Besides, they'd done no ground attacking that he'd heard about, except to hit those bridges back at Harbin. And one might as well attack a mountain as those things, Peng was sure. He had to hold on to the sill of the hatch lest the pitching of the vehicle smash him against it. It was a track specially modified for senior officers, but no one had thought to make it safer to stand in, he thought sourly. He wasn't some peasant private who could smash his head with no consequence. Well, in any case, it was a good day to be a soldier, in the field, leading his men. A fair day and no enemy in sight. "Pull up alongside the reconnaissance track," he ordered his driver.
"Who the hell is this?" Captain Alexandrov wondered aloud.
"Four big antennas. At least a division commander," Buikov thought aloud. "My 30 will settle his hash. No, let's let Pasha have him if he gets out."
Gogol had anticipated that. He was resting his arms on the steel top of the BRM, tucking the rifle in tight to his shoulder. The only thing in his way was the loose weave of the camouflage netting, and that wasn't an obstacle to worry about, the old marksman was sure.
"Stopping to see the fox?" Boykov said next.
"Looks that way," the captain agreed.
"Comrade General," the young lieutenant called in surprise.
"Where's the enemy, boy?" Peng asked loudly in return.
"General, we haven't seen much this morning. Some tracks in the ground, but not even any of that for the past 2 hours."
"Nothing at all?"
"Not a thing," the lieutenant replied.
"Well, I thought there'd be something around."
Peng put his foot in the leather stirrup and climbed to the top of his command vehicle.
"It's a general. Has to be. Look at that clean uniform," Boykov told the others, as he slewed his turret around to center his sight on the man 800 meters away. It was the same in any army. Generals never got dirty.
"Pasha?" Alexandrov asked.
"Ever kill an enemy general before?"
"No," Gogol admitted, drawing the rifle in very tight and allowing for the range.
"Better to go to that ridgeline, but our orders were to stop at once," the lieutenant told the general.
"That's right," Peng agreed. He took out his Nikon binoculars and trained them on the ridge, perhaps 800 meters off. Nothing to see except for that one bush. Then there was a flash.
"Yes,"
Gogol said the moment the trigger broke. 2 seconds, about, for the bullet to... They'd never hear the report of the shot over the sound of their diesel engines, but Colonel Waugh heard the strange, wet thud, and his head turned to see General Peng's face twist into surprise rather than pain. And Peng grunted from the sharp blow to the center of his chest, and then his hands started coming down, pulled by the additional weight of the binoculars. And then his body started down, falling off the top of the command track, through the hatch, into the radio-filled interior.
"That got him," Gogol said positively. "He's dead."
He almost added that it might be fun to skin him and lay his hide in the river for a final swim and a gold coating. But no, you only did that to wolves, not people. Not even Chinese.
"Boykov, take those tracks."
"Gladly, comrade captain." And the sergeant squeezed the trigger, and the big machine gun spoke. They hadn't seen or heard the shot that had killed Peng, but there was no mistaking the machine cannon that fired now. 2 of the reconnaissance tracks exploded at once, but then everything started moving and fire was returned.
"Major!"
General Gay called.
"Loading heat!"
The gunner punched the right button, but the autoloader, never as fast as a person, took its time to ram the projectile and then the propellant case into the breech.
"Back us up!" Alexandrov ordered loudly.
The diesel engine was already running, and the BRM's transmission set in reverse. The corporal in the driver's seat floored the pedal, and the carrier jerked backward. The suddenness of it nearly lost Gogol over the side, but Alexandrov grabbed his arm and dragged him down inside, tearing his skin in the process.
"Go north," the captain ordered next.
"I got 3 of the bastards," Boykov said. Then the sky was rent by a crash overhead. Something had gone by too fast to see, but not too fast to hear.
"That tank gunner knows his business," Alexandrov observed. "Corporal, get us out of here."
"Working on it, comrade captain." "Green Wolf to command," the captain said next into the radio.
"Yes, Green Wolf, report."
"We just killed 3 enemy tracks, and I think we got a senior officer. Pasha, Sergeant Gogol, that is, killed a Chinese general officer, or so it appeared."
"He was a general, all right," Boykov agreed. "The shoulder boards were pure gold, and that was a command track with 4 big radio antennas."
"Understood. What are you doing now, Green Wolf?"
"We are getting the fuck away. I think we'll be seeing more chinks soon."
"Agreed, Green Wolf. Proceed to divisional CP. Out."
"Yuri Andreevich, you will have heavy contact in a few minutes.